Welcome to the Games Gone with Tom Ross podcast, the very latest, and I'm absolutely thrilled to welcome an Aston Villa legend, top man as well, top defender, Sean Teal. Sean, how are we doing?
I'm all right, Tom. How are you?
If only they knew this was the second attempt. But you are, it is, I mean, you're still working, which is why we're doing it on your phone, because you are still, you never stop, you keep working.
Yeah, every day, I'm out every day, you know. The only day I don't work is Saturday and Sunday, because I like to play golf on a Sunday, and I like Saturday at home with the missus. So, you know, you have to balance your work life as it goes, and I'm busy, we're inundated with jobs at the moment, so. We're really busy 5 days a week, and then you've got to recharge the batteries. It's like being a footballer again. You've got to recharge your batteries after you've worked.
How is the missus, by the way?
Not good, to be fair, Tom. She's not been well lately.
Oh dear.
She's struggling along, but she's got things going on in the background that are never going to get to now. She's just got to live with it.
Yeah. She was my favourite wag.
No, never call her a wag, Tom.
I know, I did that deliberate. But she was my favourite, because what you saw with Carol was what you got.
Oh, yeah, she's always been like that from the day I met her. You know, I got to tell her the message.
So, I mean, I can remember to this day when she rang up the phone in and had a right pop at George Gavin.
I remember it as well. And I'm sure George still remembers it.
How many times? I can hear her now. How many times has Dwight York cleared it off the line? I can hear.
I know.
But a proper strong woman to have around you. Let's just start with you. I often see players who make it and they've come through, and they're from the age of eight, they've been treated properly, looked after. But you had the hard route in non-league. But did that make you the player you were?
Yeah, certainly, I think so. I think the grounding I got from non-league, playing against, you know, old pros and big tough guys, taught me how to look after myself first and foremost. And as I said, when we tried to start before, you know, the one thing I don't think could ever be thrown at me and Paul alongside me was that we were ever bullied by anybody. You know, if somebody wanted to go out there and have a battle, but I was quite happy to battle with anybody.
I suppose that was you were that sort of defender. I'll play whichever way you want to play. That was your motto. If you want to play, we'll play. If you want to fight, we'll fight. Whatever you want to do, I'm ready.
Yeah. I didn't care less. You know, I was given a job by Ron, and that was to defend. And if it had to be all in blood and snot, then it was all in blood and snot. If it was cover Paul and play the game, you know, I like Wembley 94, where it was all about, you know, being alert and playing the game properly, then that was fine too.
You started off, though, your first taste of league football was Bournemouth. I mean, you'd had good grounding at Weymouth and Southport, and then all the way to Bournemouth and, you know, league football. And was it Harry Redknapp who signed you?
It was, actually, yeah, Harry signed me. It started out, I was at Weymouth. I'd signed for Weymouth for quite a lot of money, actually, 25 grand, which was a lot of money in them days.
Massive.
Yeah, and straight in the team, obviously. And I played really well. I settled in really well. The family settled in Weymouth really well. And I just enjoyed my football. You know, Stuart Morgan, who took me there, was just brilliant for me. He was just what I needed at the time. Someone who believed in what I could do and believed in what I was doing. I played with an ex-pro, Paul Compton, who had been at Exeter and places like that, Torquay. So, you know, I probably learned quite a bit off Paul. I wouldn't tell him that, right, because his head's big enough. But but it was a great grounding for me, ready for league football. And when the chance came, I was, again, you have fortunes in the game. I was fortunate that the two centre-halves at the time were a big Scouser, John Williams, big 6'4" Scouser, and Kevin Bond, John Bond's son.
Yeah.
And Kevin had an issue with his hip when I got there, and they decided, because I'd signed, that they would let him go and have his operation, and I'd go in the first team. And that's how it panned out. And I went in the team and came back out. Bournemouth was weird in a sense, because they, for some reason, they had 6 player of the year trophies. And I was the first player to pick up all 6. But then I did it the second year as well. So I support left my mark on people, and the next thing I know, I'm phone call off Harry. Very strange, because we struck in because the plane had broken down. Should have been back at pre-season. Got a call off Harry. He wasn't a happy man. Basically saying, you're meeting Ron at the Royal Bath Hotel tomorrow morning. And I'm like, oh, right, great. So I've got no time to get anything organised, agents or anything. I'll just go with him. That's the way it was. I went on and met Ron, which was quite a story in itself.
Mm. What was Harry like to play for?
To play for, fine. I think we better leave it at that.
There was all sorts of stories coming out about, I mean, one laughable one that Carol tried to run him over.
It's the most laughable story ever, because she didn't have a license.
She didn't drive.
No, it was just complete bullshit. He put it in his book. It was ridiculous. And when I pulled him about it, he couldn't answer me. And I left shortly after. And to be honest, I've never forgiven him for it, because it was a pathetic story aimed at making someone look bad, when, you know, she's not like that. She was at the ground that day, and she'd been in the office. I was in a full-length plaster on my left leg, full length from ankle to hip, couldn't move. Wow. And all she was doing, my friend had took her down there so she could pick up my mail. She came back to the house in tears. My mate ended up taking me down there in my plaster to have it out with Harry. So, you know, when he came out with stupid quotes in his book about, I was always in there looking for a rise, looking for 50 quid rise, but absolute crap.
Yeah.
Absolute crap. You know, you can write a book. If you're going to write a book that's honest. I will. Trust
Tell
me.
The truth.
When I write my book, I will write a true story of every manager I've played for. That will be worth reading, trust me.
It will be. Trust. I know, I can't wait. But there you are. You met Ron to go to Villa.
Yeah.
I mean, Big Ron had a lot of time and respect for you.
His first question was, what are you strong at? What are your strong points? And I'm scratching my head thinking, well, if you don't know, we're not going to get off on a good foot here, are we? So I said, well, I think I'm fairly quick across the ground. I like a tackle and I'm strong in the air. And he went, okay.
That was your interview.
That was the interview. And then his next question, and you'll laugh at this one, Tom, his next question was, what car do you drive? And I'm like, what's he asking me that for? So I said, well, I drive a Ford Orion. You'll remember them, Tom.
Yeah, I do.
I had a Ford Orion with all the skirts on and the thing on the back and my name down the side, sponsored by such and such. He says, you can't come to Villa in that. I went, oh, right. He went, so we'll give you 15 grand to buy a better car. I went, okay then. He says, well, you should have had a club car, Sean. He says, but we haven't got any left. So you'll have to wait for me then. But 6 days later, you give me a club car. So we've got dogs joining in the conversation.
No worries. So you came to Villa. What was your first impressions of going to Villa at the time?
Again, quite funny. So I agreed on Sunday. Came up to Villa train on the Monday and was put in a hotel just by the airport. I forget what the hotel's called. It's still there. A small hotel on that main road.
The Arden.
Yeah, it probably was. I think Ron had a connection there. So, and he had a mate at the time who used to drive around in a green Rolls Royce. Do you remember him?
Yeah. Bobo was that?
No. I remember Bobo. It was a smaller fella. Mind you, everybody was smaller than Bobo. I can't remember his name. Anyway, so they picked me up on the Tuesday morning for training because we were flying to Germany. So he rolls up Ron and this fella in this roller. And I'm thinking, what the hell is going on here? This just gets weirder and weirder. I've just to play football. I don't care about rollers and things like that. Anyway, so we trained at Cadbury's that day because we were getting a lane to go to Germany for season training. So we trained at Cadbury's. So again, a little surreal training at a chocolate factory and meeting the players for the first time. So, but you know, it was what it was. There was other players there that were relatively new. Kev Richardson had only just signed. and a few of the other lads. So it was quite easy to integrate into the group. And you had no choice, really, because within 2 hours, you were sat on a plane with everybody.
Yeah. I suppose, really, that's a great way to integrate into a squad is to go away with them.
Yeah. Sure, because everybody, my first room partner, God rest his soul, was Les Seeley.
Bless him, you know, great.
What a great fella he was. Les was such a nice...
I roomed with him in the Anglo-Italian tournament with Birmingham. And he was a top man. He was a top, brilliant, top man. Classic cars was his big thing.
And big cigars.
But a great to listen to. What a goalkeeper as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I see his son now on that Cheshire Housewives thing. His son's on there, isn't he?
Is he? I didn't know. You don't watch that, do you? You've gone, have.
Do I, El? The wife watches it. They all watch it, don't they? But yeah, you walk in and out, and she stopped me one day. She said, "Hey, that's Les Seeley's lad."
Wow.
And he was a goalkeeper the same. He was at United very briefly, I believe, and got injured. Anyway, he married this woman who's on the show with him, and she's like minted, absolutely minted. And that's why they're on the show, obviously. But Les, my first meeting with Les was I was given a room key, and the shout was from Jim Barron, "Sean Taylor, Les Seeley together." Well, the story is that I smoked, as you knew. And most people, to be fair, knew. I just kept it quiet because it's not fair on kids. Kids don't want to go up thinking everybody smoked. Footballers alike. So I kept it to myself. And obviously, I was just at Villa. Nobody knew. So, and I'd snuck off a few times in the airport for a quick stick, as you do. You know, toothpaste and all that. Clean your mouth and wash your hands, blah, blah, blah. Gets into the room. And as I'm putting my bag down, I've got my back to the door. Les comes in. And he's got the biggest cigar lit ever. And I'm thinking, there is a God. It's definitely, because I can now smoke in the room without anybody minding me, because Les smokes great. And from that point, I hit it off with Les, to the point where Les obviously lived in London. When we had league games, midweek games, Les used to come after training, he used to come to ours, and he'd have a kip at ours in one of the beds at the house, and have his rest there, stay with us, have some pre-match, and then he'd go home after the game. That's how well me and Carol got on with Les. He was a star.
Absolute brilliant. I mean, tell us a bit about playing with a man that Villa fans call God. What was it like playing alongside Paul McGrath?
Well, I'll tell you the serious side of playing with Paul first before I tell you the laughable side of playing with Paul. So the serious side was he was exceptional. He was what people think he was. He was as good as people say he was, if not better.
Yeah.
His anticipation of what was going to happen was probably what made him such a good player. And I've had this conversation with Ian Taylor, with other players. You know, things like he'd be running back towards Bozzy and his position would be that crap that he'd end up backheeling the ball out the six-yard box. But he wouldn't just sit backheel out the six-yard box. He'd backheel it to one of our players 30 yards up the pitch. And the first time he did it, I thought, "You jammy so-and-so, you've got away with something there, Paul." But then he did it again and again and again, and you think, hang on a minute. He's doing it on purpose now. And he was quite flamboyant in his own sense. Yes, very quiet. Yes, very, not very talkative to most people. But when you knew him, he was quite flamboyant in his own little sense. We played cards on the coach every away game. And you'd have such a laugh with Paul because he'd be winding everybody up. But fans never saw that side of Paul. Fans only ever saw the quiet or the other side of him where in a bar.
Everything was grand. How are you, Paul? Grand. How's things today, Paul? Grand. Everything was grand because he kept himself to himself when it comes people away from the club.
Very much, very much. You know, he had a group of people that he relaxed with. Yeah. Myself, Bozzy, Dwight, Gary Parker. You know, them type of people he was very, very relaxed with. But some of the other lads, you know, he not as chatty with. But that was just Paul. It wasn't meant as anything. It was just Paul being Paul.
So, I mean, he didn't train or anything. So how did he play at that level without doing the training that you guys did?
Well, that's what makes him extraordinary because, you know, Ledley King did it for a short while, didn't he? Yeah. But not the length of time that Paul did it. But Paul did it for 10 years. You know, didn't train. Just went in the gym. for half an hour on a bike every day, maybe came out and had a kick in a five-a-side, very, very rarely, to be fair, on a Friday. And that was it for Paul. You know, the bike was his life, that gym, for half an hour and working. And
Jim Walker looked after him, didn't he?
Jim Walker should have been given a medal just for looking after Paul. Mm. Because the things he had to put up with were ridiculous. And yet he never ever let Paul down. And Paul knows that fully, obviously. You know, and Jim's had his issues with cancer. We all know that, you know, and it's sad. Yeah. But I'll tell you the tale of the first time, again, Jeremy, that I came across Paul and Paul's habits, should we say.
Yeah.
We'd finished training on the morning. Obviously, Paul didn't do a lot, probably jogged around a little bit. And then Ron was flying back to the UK with Platy because Platy was going to Bari.
Yeah.
So that's all organised. Andy Gray's taking the training. Andy Gray's taking the train. I've been joined by my dog.
Listen, family. Oh, look, beautiful. Hey, fantastic. I've got two little pups as well. They're not barking at the moment. They always pick the right times to bark. But so I remember that time because I had to go to Villa Park and meet Ron and David because he was signing for Bari.
Yeah. So Andy Gray is taking the training in the afternoon, and the afternoon session is put down as we're playing head tennis. Now, everybody knew that we were playing head tennis on a concrete tennis court, apparently, apart from Paul. So we were given a couple of hours off to rest and recuperate, ready for the afternoon session. So we decided we were in Hanover. We were in a sport hotel in Hanover. So we decided to walk down into the village mainland. So we walked down around a few of the shops. Germany, they sell Boss clothes, you know, nice clothes. Yeah. I had a look around. There wasn't a lot there. And Les just said to me out the blue, should we go and have a coffee? Yeah, why not? So we'll go and have a coffee. We walked into this cafe, and who's in the corner? Paul, with what can only be described as, I don't know how many bottles of lager empty in front of him. And he's absolutely gone. So Les says, right, forget the coffee. We need to get him in a taxi and get him up to Jim Walker. Jim will know what to do. So we get in this taxi, pours Paul in the back, gets in this taxi, gets up to Jim, passes him to Jim. Jim says, right, thanks, I'll deal with it now. So, but Andy Gray had seen him come in, so knew he was worse for wear, and insisted that he came out for training in the afternoon. So he gets down to the tennis courts. Paul comes along and he's got studs on. So Andy says, well, there's no time to change. Let's just get on with it. So he's like Bambi on ice. He is all over the place. And of course, Andy tolerates it for so long. And then it's like, right, Jim, get him to his room, blah, blah, blah. So Jim walks him up to his room, locks him in his room, takes the keys off him, takes all his money off him, and comes down to the training. So we, an hour later, we walk back up, and as you walk into the hotel, reception's on your right, the bar and the restaurant's on your left, and who's sat at the bar? Paul. So he's only shimmied down the drain pipe, and he's putting all his beers on the club's bill. Talk about, oh, honestly, class. We were in tears. And that was my first introduction to Paul, my then to be centre half partner.
I mean, I commentated loads of time. He was amazing. That first season, I remember the first season of the Premier League called the Premiership then. You were second. I mean, there was a lot of people thought you'd win it. What went wrong, really, if the wrong is the right word?
I don't know, because we can't really say we bottled it because of United, because they'd never won it for donkey's years anyway.
Exactly.
So I think we were in a position at one point, we were about 7 points ahead, and we were playing so well. We were destroying teams, really. We were just playing teams off the park. Our football was amazing. You know, we were giving nothing away, and we were scoring. And then all of a sudden, if you remember, the goals dried up.
Yeah.
Dalian got injured for a while. And the goals dried up, and we just, I don't know, we just, our confidence will to, I think we lost to, did we lose to Coventry or something like that? And we just capitulated, really. We just couldn't get going again. We ended up, I think we lost the title by 10 points.
Could that be pressure? Could it be pressure?
Well, yeah, without a doubt. Of course it was pressure. You know, you're top, with so many games to go to win the first Premiership, you're a new team as such. You know, we were only formed 13 of us, I think, the year before or in those first 2 years. So, of course, there was pressure. Did I feel pressure playing? No, not at all. And I would imagine most of the lads would say the same thing. But obviously, as a group, we failed to keep together. Yeah, and it was for whatever reason.
Big Ron, I still speak to Big Ron and I do various things with him. He's a laugh a minute. Was he like that as a manager?
Early on, yes. I would certainly say so. That first season, the 91 season, when it was still the old thingy, yes, he was. But after that, he changed. I think after 92, he certainly went down a different path with players. He wasn't as, I was going to say easygoing, but that's not right. He wasn't as demanding, or he was more demanding than he was that first season. And I think, you know, winning the Cup against United in 94 was a slight retribution for what had happened.
Yeah.
But it wasn't enough. But the problem was our league form had suffered since then. You know, we weren't actually playing that well. We were losing games. We were in fact the year he got sacked, obviously he got sacked because we were really struggling in the league. Yeah. And I don't know, he changed. He definitely changed. And Andy left, obviously, and that changed things. Jim Barron became assistant manager. And with all due respect to Jim, I think people took him with a pinch of salt a lot of the time. I don't think he had the qualifications for the lads to look at him and go, top class this lad, this fella. You know, and that's really harsh on Jim, because Jim was doing what he was asked to do, but it just didn't work for whatever reason, you know.
Players are like that, though, aren't they, Sean? Players are like that. They look at you, and if they've got respect for you, that's, you know what I'm saying? If they can, it's a really fine line, that.
Yes.
For professional footballers.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not being disrespectful to Jim, because I saw Jim at Villa Park 2 seasons ago, the season before lockdown, and that's the first time I've seen it since I left the club in 95. So that's 20-odd years.
Yeah.
16 years, sorry. You know, so, and I said hello. I've got no, you know, I didn't get on with Jim at the end very well, because he thinks I stitched Ron up. He thinks I was part of that group that got Ron the sack. Well, to be fair, I wasn't even in the team, so a bit harsh to blame me. You know, if you want to blame me, put me in the team and say I'm not playing well, but I wasn't in the team. You know, I'd had my big fallout with Ron. Ron held a grudge. Ron always did hold a grudge. And he held the grudge against me. And to be fair, I was, at the end of the day, I was glad to get out of the place while he was there. Fortunately, I didn't have to, but I was on the transfer list, certainly.
Go back a step, and, you know, that season, and I was fortunate to do that League Cup final. And the final to beat Manchester United was fantastic. But for me, I can't remember many times in my career an atmosphere like Villa Park against Tranmere.
No, I would agree. I mean, I've heard people talk about the Blackburn game that ended 6-4 or whatever. I was at that game. That was nothing like the Tranmere game. Nothing. People who are talking about the Blackburn game is because they didn't see or weren't at the Tranmere game. You know, I always remember that thing about the music playing through the stands.
Yeah.
We Will Rot You, which was supposedly illegal. And they complained about it at the end, didn't they? They weren't happy about it. The atmosphere was just incredible. You could have cut it with a knife. You know, when Aldo went down and scored the penalty to put them back in front, it was just unbelievable. It was frighteningly unbelievable. The noise that was coming out of the stands just to try and get us going again and get us back in the game. And then, of course, you know, as they say, the rest is history. Damien scores with 2 minutes to go with the header. Fantastic header. You know, people don't realise how good he was in the air.
Fantastic. In fact, in the first leg, he got the late goal that kept the tie alive, really.
Yeah, and that's never spoke about, how good a volley that was.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, God rest his soul as well. Jalen was such fun to be around and great to play with, great to have as a teammate. You know, could stir the shit up at any stage.
And often did. Play with a smile.
Yeah, yeah, unless he had the ump with Ron. But, you know, I mean, Dalian and Dino, you know, they were so funny as a pair. Yeah. They kept the, along with Gary Parker, I must mention Gary, they kept the dressing room lively because they were just mad. The three of them were nuts. And nothing was, you could never relax because something would happen. So you always had to be on your toes in the dressing room. And I think it just, camaraderie-wise, it knitted us as a group. And I think the semi-final really was all about us knitted as a group and the will as a group to get through, you know. And you know, the lads were terrific on the day. You know, Liam O'Brien will probably think he's the unluckiest player in the world. He's in that post with the free kick. But I played with Liam after and it was never spoken about.
You scored a penalty, didn't you?
I did, yes. Yes, I got off my horse. Fired it down the middle, if you remember.
Best way to do it.
The only problem with that was the quote that it came from Ron. Ron never called me John Wayne. I don't even know where that ever came from. But hey ho, it was one at a time.
Well, I think because I think I've since ended up being not true. You know, like there was one bit about John Wayne. You would call Ron called you John Wayne and stuff, and you were his John.
Never happened. He never called me John Wayne. You know, it was just for some reason the commentator was it Gary Newbon, the commentator?
No, Davis, wasn't it? Was it Alan Davis? I can't remember, but one of them, anyway.
Yeah, and he sort of said it, and here's Sean Till, tied his horse against the post, pulled the trigger, fired it down the middle. You know, and Ron calls him John Wayne. I'm like, what the hell is that about? But
but listen, it went in and from nowhere, you'd fought back.
You know, commentators are coming.
Yeah, well, you'd called back, you'd fought back, you'd got to Wembley. But even at Wembley, you were odds on, that Man U were odds on to win it, weren't they? Absolute odds on.
Can you hear me, Tom?
Yeah, I say Man U were odds on to win it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, they were going for the treble, weren't they? And nobody fancied us one bit. And I think sort of that helped us in a way because, you know, leading up to the final, we'd played every game away from home. We'd beaten Arsenal, we'd beaten Tottenham. We knew we were a good side. We just had to turn up on the day. And if we turned up on the day, we could give anybody a game. And that included United, although our results against United, apart from the draw at Old Trafford when Stan scored, had not been great.
Yeah. I remember because Big Ron was great with me and he allowed me to do a phone-in from the team's hotel. Before the final, which was truly amazing for me. But I noticed then that, and we often talk about it, but I noticed being in the hotel, what team spirit was all about. That was, you had great team spirit, didn't you, that bunch of guys?
Yeah, definitely. You know, probably the one thing you realised while you were there as well is how relaxed everybody was. Yeah. You know, nobody was tense about the final. Nobody was... I mean, they might have been panicking in their own head when they were in their own rooms, but, you know, when you saw players walking around the hotel, everybody was calm, everybody was relaxed. Probably at that point, nobody knew who the team was because Ron only told everybody the day before. So, you know, that was not a particularly nice job he had to do, obviously, because he had a squad of 20-odd down there and half of them weren't even going to be on the bench. So, you know, for those lads, it was very disappointing, and everybody who played could understand that. But we were a group of players. It didn't matter who played; it was everybody was part of it.
When did you think, or did you always think you could win it? But during the game, because there is a realization during a game, this is our day. You get that feeling. When did you get that feeling that this is our day?
I think probably by the time Dalian scored.
Yeah.
Because we'd completely nullified them as an attacking unit. We'd had really no problems at all. We would cope with everything they'd thrown at us. The one worry Ron had was Stan Staughton, because he'd only had a hernia up 3 weeks before, and it was a massive gamble to put Stan in against Andrei Kaczalski, who, you know, all fair play, the quickest. And Andre could fly. But, you know, I was given the memo from Ron, cover Stan at all costs, which was very nice of Ron, you know, because I didn't have anyone to worry about. I only had Kaczalski and Hughes to bother about anyway. You know, but it, it panned out. We nullified them. I think the one thing that I would always give Ron huge credit for is the line playing five across the middle of the park, playing daily and wide. I think was a masterstroke on the day. And it worked because it nullified their midfield. You know, and when you look at their midfield, you know, Keane, Cantona, you know, you can go on. Their team was just unbelievable. But we stopped them playing. We stopped Lee Sharp playing. We stopped Giggsy playing. We stopped Kanchelskis getting in. And I remember a comment from Giggsy years later about games against us at the time. And they always felt we were really susceptible once the ball went behind us, behind me and Paul, into wide areas. And I think on that day, it never happened. I think we stopped the crosses. We stopped people getting in behind us. And that was the formula for winning, I think.
Do you really? I mean, listen, you've played at that top level, but do you think you ever realised how big a win that was against a team that so many teams had tried to stop and couldn't, but you did?
No, I don't think. Certainly myself, I don't think I ever really. And I think I didn't realise till donkey's years later when I'd retired how big a game it was, and the, you know, what it meant to everybody. You know, all right, there's 40,000 Villa fans in Wembley, and they obviously realize what it means instantly. Yeah. I had that feeling myself when we got promoted back to the Premier League. I stood in the stand when we knew we were going up, and with Stan Collymore and Brian Small crying. It was ridiculous. You know, grown men stood there crying, looking at each other. But I couldn't help myself. It was just. The pride of Villa getting back into the Premiership was everything to me, as it was to the players years later. So I think you get to a point in your life where you realise, you know what, we played United, the best United team there's ever been for me. And we beat them. And we beat them not through any tactics. We beat them by playing them man for man. And we stopped them winning the treble, which was huge. And we were massive, massive, massive underdogs.
Was the celebrations good?
I don't remember really. Actually, to be fair, Tom, it's one of those weird things. People say, you know, when you play at Wembley, it drains you. You know, the day goes really quick. Blah 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 blah. It does. They're dead right. It did. And we finished the game and we met in the bar at Wembley, and obviously the United lads are there and they're down in the dumps. And I had a quick chat with Les, obviously, because Les was in goal for them. And he wasn't really wanting to talk, so I let him be. Had a couple of pints there, jumped on the coach, went back to the hotel, and obviously we were having to do at the Royal Lancaster where we were staying anyway. Went up to the room, got rid of my garbage, my stuff, blah, blah, blah. And Carl says, right, come on, let's go down to the room where all the celebrations are. So we went down and met, I think, Tony Daly and Michelle in the lift, and Gary Parker, whatever, went down, got a drink. Half an hour later, I wanted to go to bed. I was knackered. I was absolutely done for. And we're talking about, we're only at about 8 o'clock at night. And I'm saying to Carl, I'm going to bed. She's, you know, I said, I'm going. She kept me up till 3 o'clock in the morning. Well, along with a group of others. She wasn't the only one stopping me going to bed, but there was a group of us that just, and we just sat up, drank, had a laugh.
Energy drained.
We didn't, to be honest, Tom, we didn't even talk about the game.
No.
Because we were that, I think mentally we were that done in, we didn't want to talk about the game. We just wanted to do what we wanted to do, have a drink, you know, feel like shit. And then get up early in the morning to get home, which was not easy, I must admit.
About, because just after the final, the results sort of weren't as good, were they? Just after that final.
Is that
an effect of the final?
No, that's right. I think so. We played Everton at home midweek the following week, and I think it ended up 0-0. I think it was a 0-0 draw. It was an awful game. And we'd paraded the trophy. It was one of those games where it was like, here's the trophy, blah, blah, blah. Let's all play as flat as we can now. And our season just petered out. We were very flat. We couldn't get ourselves up for it. I think, in a way, we'd won what we wanted to win. We'd proved a point to everybody. And there was nothing left to prove. And we just, I don't know, let ourselves down, I think, really, because we just, as they say nowadays, on the beach, and I think we were more or less.
How tough was it to leave Villa, and when did you realise you were on your way?
Well, of course, it was tough to leave. You know, I never wanted to leave the club that I wanted to stay out for the rest of my career, but it wasn't going to happen. I'd had the big fallout with Ron. I knew my time was limited after that. You know, there was a certain upsurge once Ron went, because obviously Brian came in, put me back in the team, and I was enjoying my football again. He'd offered me a new contract, and then things changed in that summer, because he was pretty adamant. I got a phone call off my agent saying we need to meet Brian down at Villa Park. So I drove down from Southport. Agent drove up from London. We had a chat. We sat down, and Brian was perfectly honest, dead honest with me. You know, he was in the market for Chris Coleman from Palace at a record £3 million, which was going to leave me without a place in the team. Mm-hmm. So basically what he was saying was, listen, you can have your new contract, Sean. We're quite happy to keep you. We don't want you to leave particularly. We'll give you a new year. He didn't tell me that time. He says he did, but he did. We'll give you a new contract. That was the way the conversation went. But you're going to be sat in the stand an awful lot. And I've got a funny feeling, knowing you like I already know you after a few months, that that's not going to sit well. And I made the decision there and then on the spot. I said, well, you're quite right, Brian. I said, I I'm 31 going on 32. I want to play football. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be sat down. I want to finish my career on a high, not on a low. And I've had 6 months of a low not playing in the first team. You know, that was tough for me. It was tough for me to live with not being in that team every week. It was tough for me to go into training and put everything in. It hurt me badly. And I don't think Ron ever realised what he did, but it's the way it is. You know, he has to make a decision as a manager. I didn't agree with it. And that's the way life goes.
Interrupting you. That's the other side of the game that fans don't see, isn't it?
Of course.
Only see the glamour side. They don't see the downside for footballers.
No. I mean, listen, I was called into an England squad at the end of that season, and I got injured at Newcastle. Andy Cole went through me from behind. That doesn't sound very good, but you know what I mean. And damaged my Achilles. And instantly there was a fallout. Villa changing room at Newcastle. Ron walks in at the end of the game. We got beat 5-0. And he walks in and he went, you wouldn't have gone off if that had been Wembley, would you? And I looked at him, and it's like, well, what do you want me to do? I can't walk. So you want me to carry on playing? So there was instantly bad blood. Nothing was said, really. He said that, and I thought, I won't say what I thought. Yeah. And from there, it got worse. So 5 weeks later, the club were going to South Africa. I was called into the England team with Kev Richardson and Earl Barrett to play in 3 games at Wembley. And Ron pulled me out of the squad without telling me. Told Terry Venables I wasn't fit, pulled me out of the squad, and then pulled me a few days later when I already knew, and told me I was going to South Africa because they expected so many first teamers to go, and you'd be playing in the games.
You couldn't play for England.
So basically, I couldn't play for England, but they could strap me up and throw me in a game against Liverpool at King's Stadium in Johannesburg. Make me captain to pacify me. You know, and whatever you think, you know, I have my thoughts about Ron. I won't speak to Ron ever again. I swore I'd never say a word to him ever again, because it all fell apart on the way home, because I played in the 3 game. I got through the 3 games, which proves I could have played for England. Yeah. And I never did. And he
you never got another chance, did you, for England?
No. And I hold that against him, and I do hold that against him. Dead right I do. You know, because there's a difference between being a Premier League player and being an England Premier League player. A massive difference. Yeah. Don't care what anyone says. You know, on your CV, it's everything. And on the way home, I sat down with Jim Walker. I needed an operation on my nose because Bozzy had broke my nose the day before the cup final with it coming to punch a ball and punch me. Typical Bozzy. And I sat down with Jim Walker and Ron on the back of the at the back of the aeroplane and sorted out that I was having two operations, my nose and a hernia op, which I desperately needed. I'd played most of that last season in agony. And it was all agreed. And then we got home. I went and had my operation. Oh, I went on holiday because I was already booked to go to Florida. So I went on the family holiday in Orlando. And he blanked me, completely and utterly blanked me. Didn't even say hello. Blanked me, the one wow. The kids. And I thought, right, okay. Yeah, exactly. Wow. And I thought, this is ridiculous. So I got back home to England. I had my two operations. And Ron had said to me on that plane, and Jim Walker knows, but Jim Walker obviously has to look after his own job. I understand that fully. Jim back Ron. Where Ron had said, I get the operations done and I can have an extra 2 weeks off, come back when the Irish lads come back from the World Cup. Rehabilitation,
yep.
Back playing. That never happened because I got a phone call off Jim Barron the day the rest of the lads were due back at training pre-season. They were going to an army camp down in Andover way, down that way. And he said, I got a phone call from Jim Barron saying, where are you? And I said, well, I'm like, oh my. He said, well, you're supposed to be here. You're going to the army camp. And I said, I'm not going. He said, what do you mean you're not going? I said, well, I was given 2 weeks. Oh, no, I had a phone call off Ron last night. You've got to go. I went, well, I'm not going. He said, what do you mean you're not? I said, I'm not going. Don't you understand? I can't go. I've just had a nose operation and a hernia. What do you want me to do? I can't go. So, right, well, I'll tell Ron. So he told Ron. Ron came back from commentating at the World Cup, looking after himself as usual. Came back from there, blanked me again in the alleyway in Bodymore. Blanked me, just wouldn't speak to me. And then we get to Everton, first game of the season. He puts Hugo in, I'm on the bench. And with his smarmy way of saying things, he went, well, that's your own fault. And that was me and Ron done. I was done. I was finished with him.
You knew then that your time was over. You knew then.
I had no respect for him then. The respect I had for signing me had gone, completely gone. And it's never returned, and I don't ever want to see the man again. You know, I have a hate for him. I have a hate for him, and I have a hate for Harry Redknapp. And you know, people who treat me bad, I'm not going to be nice with them. I'm not going to be friendly with them.
You're not going to be too friendly.
I'm not going to get on with them just to please people. Why should I? You know, I told you, like I said at the start, Tom, I could write a book about my stories with managers.
You should.
There was very few I got. There was very few I got on with in the end. Because they were all after, they all looked after themselves at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And it was stuck from players.
So Villa then, and I know Villa fans at the time were unhappy that you'd gone, but Tranmere was your next step, which quite strange because you were at Tranmere in that semi-final.
Yeah,
but Tranmere was your
next. I didn't sort of rub it in though.
You never mentioned it, did you?
Well, I heard stories came out after that about when they got back to Tranmere after the game, after being beaten, they four or five of them literally destroyed the bar at Tranmere.
Oh,
they smashed the bar up. Literally smashed the bar up. So it was you know, the stories that came out were very weird. Tony Thomas and Jeb Brannan and people like that, you know, were telling me all what went on, and you know, it didn't sit well and blah blah blah. And I signed for Tranmere, and people might think it was a strange move. Listen, I'm honest, and I always say I signed for Tranmere for money and nothing else. Oh, John King, God rest his soul. I signed for John King. I had the utmost respect for John King because what John King did, he did for everybody, for the players, for everybody. Nothing was about John. It was about everybody else. And he was treated like a pile of crap in the end by Tranmere, put in his ivory tower and paid off because he couldn't afford to pay him. Made to go to work every week because he couldn't afford to pay him off. Well, that's another story. Well, so I signed because, yes, Brian had offered me, well, Brian had offered me a new deal, but not offered me any terms. I didn't know what the terms were. I wasn't on great money at Villa. Well, and, you know, I don't know what people think I was on, but it wasn't what people would think. It was nowhere near what people would think. So I had nothing in my pension. I had a family and a long time to live to look after myself and Carol and the boys. So when Tranmere came and my agent told me what the deal was, it was just a no-brainer. I had no choice. I was going to fill my pension pot within 3 years, and I was going to earn more than I was in at Villa playing in cup finals and coming second in Premier Leagues.
You were better off going to Tranmere?
Yep, better off.
Oh, gee whiz.
And not by a little, by a lot.
Well, I mean, you went to other clubs. I know you went to China, you went Motherwell, your Scottish football, Carlisle, Southport. But then you went non-league again. But you were successful in non-league. Didn't you lift a trophy? Didn't you lift the
FA trophy.
The FA trophy.
Yeah, what a journey that was. We're the smallest team ever to win it. So we come from a village of 8,000 inhabitants. It's literally 10 minutes up from where I'm sat now. And I took the job because I knew the chairman already. Again, not a great fan of his anymore, but there you go. Sat me 5 weeks after winning the trophy just because of something that was said. Didn't like it. You know, childish, spit your dummy out. So I took the job on, and I really enjoyed the role of being player manager. You know, I got the respect of the players. I treated the players like my mates. I had some players who had played league football who knew what the game was about. Top non-league players. We sucked about 10 players in that first season from different teams that were better than us, and we knew were better than us. We offered them a contract and a nice deal. But they came because they wanted to come and play for me, and I knew that.
Brilliant.
And you know, again, I had the utmost respect for every single one of them, and every single one of them pulled their tripe out for me that season. And when we won the trophy at Villa Park against Tamworth, It was everything the lads deserved. And of course, the spotlight fell on me straight away. A, because it was at Villa Park and I'm a former Villa player. And that's where the fallout came. quite strangely, I decided I was staying in Birmingham after the final, whether we won or lost. I was going to stay in Birmingham. I didn't know what was going on with the team because the club had not said anyway. They decided to go back to the tiny village of Berska. And I refused to go because I knew what was going to happen. We'd get back there. It would all be about Sean Teale winning the FA trophy at Villa Park, blah, 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 blah. And the players would get ignored. And I just felt, you know what? I'm going to cut myself off. I'm going to have my little celebration with the friends. I'd booked a hotel and paid for 12 rooms. I wasn't about to go back to Berska. I'd have been skint.
Yeah.
You know, and my mates would have been there. As it happens, I can't remember much about the night because I think I hit bed by midnight. But I wanted the players to have the glory, and they got back to Berska. They couldn't get the coach into the ground for people. It was ridiculous. Everybody in Berska was around that ground. They had to get the players off and walk them to the bar. They got the bar. There was no beer left.
But you let them have a taste of the glory.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I got back the next night. We did a TV thing on the pitch, filled the ground with 2,500 fans, I think it held at the time. And we did a walk around the pitch with the fans, and I did that with the players. But again, I tried to stay out in the spotlight. I tried to let the players soak it in and enjoy it. Because I'd had that at Wembley. You can't beat that. You know, the crowning glory for winning the trophy for me was, and I say it to this day, and people don't really know where it comes from, was being involved in Aston Villa and the way Aston Villa looked after us as a tiny little club. And I know that was because of me, but I wanted the players to soak it up. So we came down on the Thursday. We stayed in the hotel till the Sunday, till the cup final day. We got pissed the first night together because I said the lads could go to the bar and have a drink. It was the Thursday. Friday, Saturday, you recoup it. We trained Friday, Saturday, down at Bodymore. We were given open doors at Bodymore.
Brilliant.
Jim Paul and Ian washed the kit for us every day. It was all hung out like pros every day. The lads didn't even have to touch the boots. It was that good. We went around Villa Park. I took my assistant manager to go meet Doug in his office. What a laugh that was, because all he talked about was Southport.
Because he was once a reserve.
And he invented the bicycle kick.
Of course.
But fair play to Doug, and my assistant manager Ray lapped it up. He loved every minute of it. The lads love going around the ground, going on the pitch the day before, soaking up, because you soak up an atmosphere at Villa Park, whether there's anybody in the stand or not.
Yeah.
It's that type of place.
Yeah.
It's daunting when you walk on that pitch. And we were given freedom to walk on the pitch to do what we, you know, obviously not take a ball out, but walk around, get soak it up. And then on the day, we were given the away dressing room, which is the bigger dressing room, which was fine. It didn't matter. At that time, the dreams aren't like they are now, you know. You don't have Pampers by your place now.
So just tell me about, you were more than just a tough defender, but you were known as a tough defender. How do you react now watching people rolling around and screaming out loud? I mean, how do you react?
It kills me. Well, it's, you know, the game is not the game anymore, is it? You know, what I played in the early 90s were, you know, I could go and clatter Alan Shearer, knowing full well I was gonna eat an elbow at some stage. And that was part and parcel of the game. The physical contact was part of the game. Now it's just ridiculous. You know, you've got players making out they've been elbowed in the face, and the elbows barely touch them, and they go down like they've been shot. And it's embarrassing, Tom. Honestly, it's embarrassing. But I understand the game's changed and we have to live with that. Whatever I think of people rolling around is irrelevant because I don't play in the game now. I played in the game when it was different.
I suppose really, and I'm not being rude to you, I think you'd have probably been, in the modern game, you'd have probably been sent off in the tunnel.
Yeah, well, when people ask me, I always say, well, I'd give it 5 minutes, you know, just time to get two tackles in. But yeah, I couldn't survive. I'd have had to change my game completely, and then I wouldn't have been a top professional because, you know, I'm not stupid. I know talent wise, I wasn't the most talented player in the world. I'm not stupid. I realise that, you know, but I had something that a lot of other players didn't have. I had a massive heart, and I could tackle, Tom, and I could head a ball,
sure,
and I could stop people getting past me. And I made a living out of that, you know. And I'm certainly not the only one who's gone down that road. There's plenty around at the time that was very similar to myself, you know.
You still get your boots on, don't you, now and again? Charity games?
Yeah, I still play in a charity game. I'm involved in a charity team. I'm actually player manager for All Stars charity team, which has now become a. It was a very small thing to start with, and it's now become huge. So we've now become a travel charity team. So we're going to Glasgow Rangers to play a Rangers team. We're playing an NHS team down in... Oh, we're playing them in Fleetwood first, and then we're playing them in Birmingham the following year. We're in negotiations to get a Midlands 11 to play. We're going... Gavin Price, you remember Gavin?
Yes.
He's manager of the Welsh National Vets team. So we're going to play the Welsh National Vets team down in Cardiff, I think. And we're in negotiations for a team that for Bournemouth and a player team down on the south coast.
We'll have to get you down here. I manage the Blues All Stars, the ex Blues players charity team. So we'll have to get you down here and give you a spanking.
Well, I think Stephen Withers is going to organise a Midlands 11. So there'll be, you know, a mixture of Blues, you know, your Paul Devlins and people like that. I'm sure will turn out for a good cause.
Be great,
Part of the whole thing is what one of it's for Dementia UK, because my mum suffers with dementia,
yes.
Bless her. And the other one is the Lee Rigby Foundation. For people who don't remember Lee,
Lee was the soldier
that got murdered in London. Well, his parents are part of the charity team. They're part of the committee, along with an awful lot of other unnamed people that have put an awful lot of hard work in over the summer. And in fact, I've got my first meeting with them on Thursday to get everything finalised for the first game, 26th of June. I've asked Lee Hendry and Stan to play, but I've not had an answer yet. So I'll be ringing a few necks soon.
Well, keep in touch if you need any help, because I've got all the numbers locally. But listen, it's been, I can't tell you what an absolute pleasure. It's just flown by. It's been
brilliant.
Folks, he's Sean Teal, and please leave a review. If you love this podcast, I'm sure you will, leave a review, with an honest one. If you love it, tell me. If you don't like it, tell me. Whatever you do, leave it. And it's been absolutely brilliant. Sean, thanks for taking the trouble to talk to us, mate. Thank you.
You're welcome, Tom. You take care, mate.